Hello again. This is Brenda Dunn at ICRL, welcoming you to our newest podcast. Today we have the distinct pleasure and honor of speaking with Dean Radin. Dr. Radin is one of the leading researchers in the area of consciousness and has been working in this field for a long time and has done many of the most important experiments in this field. I regard him as a personal friend, a colleague. Furthermore, he's a great guy, and we're just delighted to have him with us today. Hello, Dean. Welcome to ICRL.
Thank you, Brenda. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Dean, you have written a number of books. I think probably your most well-known book is The Conscious Universe, which most people who have an interest in this field are familiar with. But I know you've written some others, and you have a new book that came out fairly recently. Tell us a little bit about your other writings and if you're working on anything else at the moment.
Sure. It's true. My first popular book called The Conscious Universe, I actually wrote about 80% of that book when I was at Princeton.
And, oh, dear.
Yeah. And nobody wanted to publish it. So the manuscript just sat there for almost 10 years. And then, as often happens, if you become a minor celebrity for 10 minutes, then publishers will call you because they don't really want to do much publication, and they figure they can just ride off the coattails of being popular. So the thing that did it for me was that, for reasons I still don't completely understand, in 1996, I was featured in a New York Times Magazine article, and the next day, I got 4 or 5 calls from major publishers saying, "Have you ever thought about writing a book?"
Wow.
And I said, boy, do I have a manuscript for you. So I sent them what I had written, and they said, this is great. So when would it be finished? And I said, well, I could probably bring it up to date and finish it in, I don't know, 3 months. And they said, fine. So that's what turned into The Conscious Universe. And I did update it to 1996 and was published the next year. And then my next book, Entangled Minds, I wrote in 2006. And then my most recent book is Supernormal, which was published last year, 2013.
Well, these things do have a way of making their own time frame, don't they?
Yeah, I guess the public or somebody, the publishers at least, were not ready in 1986 when I first wrote it, but 1997 they were.
Well, I don't know if you recall, but somewhere around 1986, when you were at Princeton, mm-hmm. Bob and I were working on Margins of Reality.
Right.
And we ran into the same kind of difficulty trying to get a publisher interested. It's a topic that makes people a little uncomfortable. They don't know quite what category it belongs in.
Right.
So we certainly can empathize with that. But what about now? You, somewhere in there, or a little later, you were featured on that television program or movie, What the Bleep.
Right.
Did that help promote your second book?
Yeah, it did. The original What the Bleep was a shorter film. And then because of feedback that the producers got from people saying, well, this is all very interesting, but is there any evidence for it? Then they made a second film called What the Bleep Down the Rabbit Hole.
Right.
And that's the part that I was interviewed for. And yes, it every time there's anything that makes a bump in the news, you see an immediate change in sales.
Well, I don't know about you, but I think we had the largest bump in the news at Pear when we announced we were closing. That seemed to be our greatest accomplishment as far as the media was concerned. But
and it probably was reflected by book sales.
Well, you know, our book has, as one our former editor pointed out, our book sales graph looks very much like our REG data. Mm. Unlike most books, which have a big peak and then fall off, Our book just goes chunkity, chunkity, chunk, and it sells about 100 copies a year, and it's still selling 100 copies a year in just a very small effect size that gradually reaches a statistically significant point.
Well, that's good. There's something to be said for replication.
There certainly is, and we're just delighted if that people are still reading it.
Right.
But this supernormal, which I have read recently and found delightful, makes some very interesting connections between psi phenomena, if you want to call it that, and yoga, which is really fascinating. It takes us back to an older tradition that goes way beyond the origins of modern science. And it's really quite striking to discover that all of these wonderful insights we're gaining through our scientific research were already well known and well described a couple of thousand years ago.
Right.
How did you get onto that track?
Well, it was a confluence of two things. In 2010, I was invited to be the national visiting professor of the Indian Council for Philosophical Research, which is part of the Division of Human Resources for the Indian government. And so that council has mostly internal affairs. It supports professors and postdocs and researchers within India who are interested in philosophy. And actually they call it philosophical research. I wasn't quite sure what kind of research was involved. It's scholarly research. But they also have this division where they bring in people from the outside to talk about either Indian philosophy or things that are relevant to it. So I was invited by Ramakrishna Rao, who for many years was the director of the Rhine Research Center and a long-term Psi researcher. And initially, I wasn't entirely sure what to talk about because I'm absolutely not an expert in Indian philosophy. But I decided that what I could talk about that might be interesting to Indian academics, mostly, was what does science have to say about Patanjali's Yoga Sutras? And in particular, the third book of the Yoga Sutras, which is all about the special abilities that arise as a result of disciplined meditation practice. And of course, I have read the Yoga Sutras many years ago, and I remember that Chuck Onerton, one of our colleagues, wrote about it, as well as another colleague, William Broad. And they both pointed out many, many years ago that the kinds of things that we're studying, psi phenomena of various types, and even things that might be further into a mystical experience, these were very well recognized as being real effects long before there was even a written language. And so Patanjali's Yoga Sutras was the first time that the classical yoga was put into written form, and at that point it had only been an oral tradition, probably around for at least several thousand years, but nobody actually knows.
And then along comes Descartes, and we end up with a mind-body problem, which had been solved several thousand years earlier.
Well, I'm not sure that it was solved. I mean, the interesting thing is that from an experiential point of view, from an introspection point of view, it was well recognized that there are many refined states that we would think of as states of consciousness. And they were pretty well mapped out as well. But they didn't, you know, you think of ancient wisdom in that regard, but the ancient wisdom people didn't invent the iPhone.
Yeah.
So there's a disconnect between the kind of knowledge and wisdom that they developed versus what we know today. And so one of my hopes here is that by pulling towards us wisdom, ancient wisdom that is verifiably true, and combining it with the kinds of wisdom that science has developed, it will create a new integration that is actually better than both.
Yes, which again goes back to yoga and the yoking or integrating of different perspectives.
Right.
What do you think is, if you were to summarize in 25 words, or I'll give you 30 words, what do you think the findings from your research and other research over the last few years have actually contributed to that dialogue with the ancient traditions?
I don't think I could do that in 30 words.
All right, try 35.
Yeah, even 35 would be tough. I guess what I would say is that the scientific methods are so powerful that they could even be applied to ancient wisdom, most of which seems qualitative from the point of view of the precision that science has been able to create. And some of it can be then verified. And that's important, because if it's not verifiable, and I'm way over 35 words, if ancient wisdom cannot be verified using current methods, then nobody today is going to believe it.
Right.
But since some of it can be verified, it suddenly casts things like the Yoga Sutras into an entirely different light. And the way I put it is that maybe Patanjali was writing fairy tales. I mean, after all, he's writing about mystical states and psychic phenomena and all kinds of strange things. And it could be seen from today's point of view as fairy tales. But we know that some of those things he was writing about are true, as best as science can tell us, in which case some of the other things he's talking about are much more likely to be true. And that gives us a different way of thinking about the nature of reality.
So on the one hand, what I hear you saying is our scientific methodologies and our scientific research can verify or validate, if you will, certain aspects of the Yoga Sutras. But on the other side of the coin, it also brings attention of the scientific community to the wisdom that is in this tradition, and perhaps helps to bring a different slant to the mystical dimension of human experience.
Yes.
Misrepresenting you there?
Nope, that's well stated, yep. So one of the issues here is that what has science been able to look at in some detail? Well, it's the classic parapsychological phenomena, four or five classes of things that there have been many experiments on. But the Yoga Sutras goes way beyond that. And so there you can find roughly 25 special abilities that are said to occur as a result of disciplined practice, including things like inedia. And that term is not a yogic term. That actually comes from Catholicism. And it means to live without eating. And it's one of the hallmarks of the Catholic saints, that at some point they'd go into some sort of ecstatic state that just stays there and they stop eating. And sometimes they don't eat for 20 years. And they don't seem to fade away either. They seem to be doing perfectly well. So that is a major challenge to today's understanding of nutrition and how the body uses energy and all that stuff. And if it is true, and it's been difficult to prove to anybody's satisfaction that this is in fact true, but if it's even mildly true that we could eat for, I don't know, 300 calories a day or something like that and feel perfectly fine, then that is not only a major challenge to a large chunk of what we understand about the human body, but it also could be very pragmatically useful in that there are lots of people who are starving to death. And maybe if they were doing a certain kind of practice, they wouldn't have to worry about eating so much.
Yeah, I guess the issue does come down to this term of discipline or practice. You know, in one sense, doing science is a practice or a discipline, and it does require focus and concentration and learning, but it comes from a different part of ourselves, more of our intellectual side than the spiritual kind of discipline that yoga and some of the other traditions recommend. Mm-hmm. I think you'll have some trouble convincing some of the people who are selling diet regimens on the internet that people can really live on 300 calories a day and get by very well. I think even the people more seriously who are working with the many starving people in the world think that it's very likely that people who are in that condition or living in those circumstances are going to want to put any attention into some kind of spiritual practice.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, if you're in a position where you don't have the luxury of being able to ease into it, because in the Yoga Sutras, it's very clear that it takes years of practice and the ability to do the practice without too many distractions in order to achieve some of these so-called superpowers. And so you don't want to take somebody who is in an unfortunate situation and tell them, well, start meditating and then you don't have to eat anymore.
Right.
That's not going to work.
And furthermore, you get distracted by the fact that it's your kid that's starving, not just you.
And everybody else.
And everybody else around you. So that makes it
right.
a bit of a distraction. But
right.
on the other hand, the careful studies that you and other people have done have clearly validated some of the cities, some of the perhaps smaller scale ones. Do you find that there's any response to this connection with this practice? Or, I mean, it's something that seems fairly self-evident to people who have worked with it, that what is going on in these kinds of experiments when one gets results is that there's a transcendence of the sort of everyday consciousness, awareness, you know, cognitive mind, and something else is taking place. In mm-hmm. our own work, we refer to it as resonance.
Mm-hmm.
How does this fit in? Do you think the scientific community is ready to accept the idea of resonance beyond the domain of pendulums?
In a word, no. What I see happening in this domain is what's happened in every domain about psi research, which is that people see what they want to see, and they believe what they want to believe, and it's almost impossible to change one's belief, because evaluation of evidence is only partially rational, and probably to a smaller extent than we'd like to believe. And so the people who I've seen resonate with my book Supernormal are already people who are doing yoga, including scientists who are doing yoga and are interested in it. They're much, much more open to this, partially because of their own practice and partially because of something like temperament, that they see value in doing these kinds of practices.
That's interesting. Has anybody ever looked at that in exploring the so-called experimenter effect?
Looking...
meditation or yoga or spiritual practices among experimenters who get positive results versus those who only get chance results.
Mm. I don't know if anyone has actually looked at that specifically, but I would say, based on the people I know who have good track records, that they all have at least some interest in matters that might be called spiritual.
Well, I think I agree with you that no matter how much evidence you can put together, you're not going to persuade somebody who doesn't want to hear it. It seems that the only real impact on people like that is when they have their own experience on a subjective level.
Or have the right temperament.
Yes.
So I say that because I did not grow up having psychic experiences, and nor did anyone else that I knew. And nor did we grow up in any religious sense or even a spiritual sense. But I just somehow knew, as for as long as I can remember, that there was something there, which I had no name for even. There was something else that was palpably real, which, because I didn't have any background in it and no one around me was interested in such things, I didn't know what to call that. But now as an adult, I look back and I can say that there are just some children who grow up in a particularly sensitive way or something that they know certain things. And so in today's term, I would say it's something like a knowing that is not rational, but also not irrational. It's some other form of knowing.
Or having the innate quality of compassion or kindness. You know,
some of it. Yeah, some of it is.
Dean, you're a very funny guy, but underneath all of your humor, you're one of the kindest people I know.
Yes, I am. I'm very, very kind. I'm just very kind. And so some of it might be compassion and kindness. It may manifest that way, but it's even something beyond that.
Yeah.
If I had to use words for it, I would say it would be something like empathy.
Yes. Okay, that's a better word for it.
Yeah.
You know, I recall a visitor who came to see us years ago who put the situation so very beautifully. He said, I asked him why he was interested in this topic, and he said, well, I'm really tired of having to choose between my head and my heart. I have both. And there you have, you know, the definition of a scientist with empathy.
Right.
It's not you don't learn empathy in science school. Neither do you learn scientific method in empathy school. So
right.
It's finding a path to integrate both of those. And I guess, it, as you say, it takes an exceptional person who can do that without feeling totally schizoid.
I don't know about that. I think it is somewhat unusual, but it's not a choice. It's as though you have a certain temperament that allows you to swim in large swamps of uncertainty without getting all bothered by it.
Yeah.
So one of the things I see a characteristic among people who are not properly skeptical, but kind of crazy skeptical, is that they can't stand ambiguity.
Yes.
And the reality is the world is full of ambiguities. There are only a very small subset of things that are stable enough for us to have any confidence in them. You know, that's their temperament. They probably can't change even if they wanted to.
You put your finger on it. Another little anecdote of, you know, for many years we used to have groups of 10-year-old school children visiting us at the Pear Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And when I used to talk to them and talk about the scientific method and so forth, I'd ask, how many of you want to be scientists when you grow up? And there'd always be a large group of hands that shot up. And I'd tell them, well, you know, there's two things you have to learn to say if you are going to be a good scientist. One of them is, I don't know.
Right.
The other one, which is even tougher, is, I was wrong. And I can remember one little girl who said, oh, Mrs. Dunn, I can't even say that to my brother. And this is very relevant to science. Scientists are people who are supposed to be learning about things we don't yet know, and yet they can't acknowledge that there's something they don't know.
Right.
Or that their theories or models or hypotheses could possibly be wrong. And that is even beyond the empathy. I think that the humility that entails should be a requisite for any good scientific practice. But
right.
we don't get taught that either.
Well, and not only that, but the whole academic structure does not honor humility. It honors arrogance and certainty. And so that's a problem. You have a structure that is not promoting the very thing that you actually need to promote.
You know, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but as we've talked about and written in our work, we've come to believe that one of the essential ingredients in any kind of psi phenomena is uncertainty, which is, I don't know, basically. Is that something that you feel applies to the work you've done as well?
Oh, absolutely. I'm always pleasantly surprised when an experiment works. But unfortunately, it seems to work more often than not, which is why I've kept my interest in this field. I'm pretty sure that if the first couple of experiments that I ran didn't work, I might still think there was something to it, but I would have lost interest quickly and have gone on to something else. But they do work, and they're associated in some way to not pushing it. You allow things to unfold. And interestingly, the similar kind of idea comes out of the Yoga Sutras, that the way that you get a siddhi to occur, a supernormal ability, is first you have to sustain samadhi.
Mm.
Well, samadhi is a mystical union state.
Yes.
There's no effort at all on anything. And the superpower comes out of an extremely minor intentional spin that you put onto it. And the moment you start pushing it or you put your ego involved, it disappears. So
we've seen that over and over again. You know, we used to get these patterns that we used to call fish hooks.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd see an effect over time that would be chugging along very nicely in the intended direction. And then all of a sudden would go zoom back to the chance level.
Mm-hmm.
And you could almost inevitably predict that it was at that inflection point that the operator said, oh my God, this is working.
Right.
Or translated, look, hit me. I'm in samadhi.
Yes. And I see that, of course, we see that at the experimental level, too. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not an individual, if the experimenter has that sense. I'll tell you a story that we're running an experiment. We're using optical systems as our target for PK. And we did a new version of this thing, and we planned 20 sessions with 20 different people. And we were up to session number 18. And if we got the same effect that we had seen in the previous 18, we would have ended up with a 5-sigma result. Well, that's pretty good in 20 sessions. So I was sort of sitting there with fingers crossed saying, I hope these last two people just, even if they just do chance, we're home free.
Right.
Both of those two sessions were significantly negative.
I've seen that too.
Yeah. And of course, in this case, they didn't know any better. The subject had not done this experiment yet. It was me that probably caused this to happen, even though I wasn't even the person running them. I let my assistant run the people in the experiment, and yet somehow my intention is wrapped into the whole process, as we well know, and I caused it to go opposite.
That's the ultimate challenge in this business, isn't it?
Yeah. Keep involved, but not too involved.
Right, because the whole thing is part of the same system. The experimenter, right. The participant, the device, the environment, the expectations, the staff, you know, you can't separate those out. And, of course, science is a field where we're trained to separate variables out one by one.
Right.
And this is the real tough part about research in this area. But tell me a little more about this optical experiment. This is a very important experiment because it flies in the face of one of the most fundamental experiments that demonstrates quantum mechanics. Aren't you getting people upset with that?
No, I don't think people are upset. I think more likely they're just not paying attention to it.
Well, that's why they're not upset.
Yeah.
Can you describe that experiment a little bit for our listeners?
Well, so this is following on work that was first done, as far as I know, by Stan Jeffers at York University. And then he gave his equipment to Mike Ibbison, who is at the Pear Lab at the time. And this is all about the use of a double-slit optical system, which is a physics 101 way of demonstrating the wave and particle nature of light. And it's a very nice target to use for a psi experiment because any form of psi, whether passive perceptual or active form of psychokinetic something, almost anything would change the nature of the interference pattern, which is a reflection of whether photons are behaving like waves or like particles. So the way it was originally cast by Jeffers and then by Mike Ibbison was that if you could gain which path information, meaning you know which of the two slits that a photon goes through, that would so-called collapse the wave function. And you would make the wave-like property of light turn into particle-like. And the interference pattern would reflect that by very dramatically changing what it looks like. So that's the kind of system we use, both continual laser-driven version and also one that uses single photons. And we simply ask people to imagine that they can see what's happening at the double slit and see the photons. And it works. It actually works much better than any study I've ever seen using a random number generator. So that's one of the reasons why we've continued to work with these as target systems. And including what we've been doing now for about 2.5 years, which is a version of this that works over the internet. And there we can very rigorously isolate the people in the experiment from the machinery itself. Mm. And we can also run what we call robots, which are simulated humans, where we have a computer access the website and does everything that a human would do, but of course there's no one watching. It's just a Linux box doing the experiment. So it gives us a rigorous way of looking at the difference between human observation and a machine that's observing. And the results are very clear. We get a very clear difference between human observation and a machine observing the system. independent of where the people are that are doing the experiment.
That's an elegant design. You know, when Stan brought his device down to Princeton and we ran it there, we got some very strong effects on the same device, same box. The big difference I discovered was when he came down, I asked him, tell me how you introduce this experiment to your operators or your subjects. And he then proceeded into a rather lengthy and frankly tedious description of optics that went on for some time and, you know, had my eyes sort of rolling in my head. And then he says to the participant, you know, there are some people who think you can actually influence this. And, of course, I inside went, bingo, I see your problem, Stan. So when we ran the experiment at Pear, we didn't go through the optics thing. We simply told people this was a new experiment that involved light and photons that I wasn't qualified to go into a major description, but we could certainly arrange for someone to explain as much of it as they would like. But basically what we wanted them to do was to get this line to go up or down. And they said, oh, that sounds like fun. And they succeeded beautifully. It was very impressive, but it also, I think, was very indicative of the expectation of the experimenter influencing the behavior or performance of the operator.
Oh, absolutely.
You just can't. There are some people. That's a killer line right there. The other question I've always had about this wave particle experiment, or any of the wave particle experiments that have been described, is whether the assumption that waveness or particleness are qualities of the physical system that are complementary, or whether the wave or particle is a question, whether the wave and or particle are actually characteristics of the human observer, that the individual who is doing the experiment may approach this experiment or approach the particle, if you will, the photon, as a wave, which of course brings in this issue of resonance again in a different context, but not totally, or as a particle, which is a separate unit that is distinct from the observer. Anyway, I'm just rambling here. These are just some thoughts I've had on my own when thinking about these double-slit experiments and what they might be telling us. Maybe they're telling us a lot more about our own minds than they're telling us about the nature of photons.
Well, nobody really knows what a photon is. What that experiment tells us is that the nature of the way it behaves, whatever it is, it behaves differently depending on how we look at it. And that's why as a target for some kind of mental interaction, it's a very nice target. But it's true. It doesn't. We are always inferring at those elementary particle levels what the thing actually is. We don't know what it is.
Yeah, it reminds me of what was the line of the famous baseball umpire who said, there's some of them's balls and some of them's strikes and some of them ain't nothing till I call them.
That's exactly it, yep.
And then, of course, there's also the issue of the biophoton emission associated with living creatures such as us. If we do emit photons, then at some level we're light entities. And at that level, we know very well what a photon is and how to utilize it. Has anything ever been done with looking at the connection between those? I mean, they're two different fields, really.
Right.
But it would be interesting to know whether one could monitor the biophoton emission of the operator while the operator is affecting the photons in the experiment.
Well, I believe just recently, where did I read this, that if you ask somebody, oh, it's by Michael Persinger's group up in Canada, that if you ask people to send more photons out the right side of their head than the left side, and using a photomultiplier to detect that, in a completely dark room, that in fact they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can, simply through an active imagination, basically, you can direct your body to emit more photons in one place versus another. I thought you were going to ask, what if you use biophotons in a double slit device? See, because...
All right, that's good.
Yeah, because yeah. Then, if it turns out that I don't think we have much conscious control over each photon, but what if those photons weren't just little non-living elementary particles, but had some sort of sentience to them,
right,
as I kind of suspect everything does? What if you could send little sentient light particles through a double slit where you instruct each little particle to know what it's doing? Because if it knows what it's doing, it has to behave like a particle. And then you can direct other ones to go through and say, well, you're going to behave like a wave. And then just basically see what happens. You would see immediately by the interference pattern whether the photons are obeying your command, essentially.
That's beautiful. Why don't you do it?
Well, it's partially because you would need, let's see, what would you need?
Well, you'd need to be in a very dark room, for one thing.
Yeah, but that's the easiest thing. That's the easy part.
And have the photo multipliers working.
So we have a single photon double slit system.
Right.
And the way it works is that the photons go through two slits, and then they'll end up in an interference pattern, which you can calculate. But you need to know that the photons are coming from a particular direction and collimated.
Right.
So I suppose you could set up a person and then a single slit to collimate the light and then a double slit. And, yeah, you could do it. Of course, there you're getting something like 10 photons per second or less. So it would take quite a while. But, yeah, but we could do that. Okay, that's the next experiment then.
All right. Now, that would be just fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love the idea that you've carried on this work, because that was... That was a very interesting experiment, and we didn't follow up with it too much after that. We did an initial study and got, I think, the largest effect sizes we'd seen in any of our earlier work, but mm-hmm. we didn't pursue it much further. So I'm so pleased that you've picked up on that and have taken it well beyond, you know, where we dropped off, and I hope you'll stay with it.
Well, so far, so good. It's as a target, it's an interesting one. And I'm now working with a version that uses a much, much more stable laser and a much smaller footprint, like a little box. And so far, that, too, is getting very interesting results.
Well, I look forward to hearing about what you learn with this. Are you doing research on anything else at the present time? I know you've done an awful lot of work on presentiment, where people were displaying some sort of biological or physiological response to a stimulus before the stimulus arrived, which, a non-local or a non-temporal effect that is fascinating. Are you still doing work in that area, or...
No, I haven't done research on presentiment for a couple of years. And part of the reason is you do what your grants allow you to do.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it becomes clear after a while that if you're the only lab that's doing a particular kind of research, that no one's going to believe it. You have to get other people involved in it. And then it's through replication that people begin to see it as something real. So after a number of years of doing presentiment work, I decided to wait to see if others could repeat it. And then since a meta-analysis was published a few years ago with something like 36 replications and showing overall whoppingly good results, I figured my job is done.
Right.
And, of course, there's many additional things that can be learned. Like we did a study with advanced meditators with a simple presentiment task to not so much to look at presentiment per se, but to study the claims of advanced meditation, which says that they get the feeling that they sometimes go into a state of spaciousness, one way that they describe it.
It's a lovely phrase.
A spaciousness in which the passage of time seems to disappear. Now, interestingly, that is the very first city that is described.
Yes, exactly.
Which is that you perceive past, present, and future all at the same time. So we said, well, if that's really true, then you should be able to present the stimulus in the future, and maybe some of it would actually be picked up unconsciously in the present. And so we did an experiment like that with meditators and non-meditators and got a whoppingly good result with the meditators, but not in the non-meditators. So that's using the concept of presentiment as a process that you can use in a laboratory, but applying it then to claims of meditation rather than simply looking for a transtemporal effect.
Well, it's fascinating work. The independence of these phenomena of distance or time, whether it be microseconds or days, or whether it be a few inches or, miles, is one of the most challenging aspects of psi phenomena and makes it so very difficult to try to come to grips with a model that can explain it, because that defies any known force or process that we're aware of. And of course, as you pointed out in your book, if you have a model and then you do an experiment and the experiment confirms the model, you say, hey, that's great, success. And if it doesn't, you say, oh, too bad. But when you don't have a model and you are just collecting data and trying to fit the pieces together into a model, that becomes more of a challenge because you don't have any framework to guide you in putting those pieces together.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we actually do have a model for effects that don't seem to be bound by space-time. And the best model that we have is quantum entanglement, which does not occur in space-time. And the usual complaint that I get mostly from physicists is that you're using one mystery to explain another.
Yeah.
And my response is, in some respects, that's true, except that we're looking at two mysteries that appear to be exactly the same thing. They're the same mystery, in which case it is simply reasonable to assume that if at the level of human experience we can experience what is seen in the laboratory for quantum phenomena, then that is exactly what we would expect for all of the whole range of various kinds of psychic phenomena.
Of course, for those folks, the quantum mechanical processes are not supposed to work on the macroscopic level.
But we know that that's no longer the case.
Right.
The new generation of quantum physicists know very well that you can have very large systems, including ones that you can see with your eye, that are in quantum coherent states. And even more so, that living systems appear to have evolved in such a way as to take advantage of quantum coherence. So old prejudices that assume that none of this could be relevant are slowly going away with one generation after the next.
Well, it would seem that there is a, shall we call it, an organizing principle at work in all of this. It's not a principle that, one can define mathematically, but it does seem as though the psi phenomena, for example, most of the psi phenomena, the experiments have shown a slight ordering of a random process.
Mm-hmm.
Information being introduced into randomness. The entanglement concept also involves that in a different sort of way, in that it goes in the other direction, but you now have two apparent entities that are entangled, that are unified as a single one. And therefore, the terms and the qualities that describe this entangled system are going to be different than those used to describe the individual components. So this is an ordering principle also. It's taking two independent, if you will, or two systems perceived as being independent, and now entwining them or entangling them so that they become a unified system. And that's an information ordering process as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually used this idea in looking at a field consciousness experiment that we ran last year at this time at Burning Man at the festival. We had six random number generators in the desert with Burning Man and predicted that during the primary event of the festival, when they burned the effigy of the man, At that time, there were 65,000 people in the middle of nowhere with nothing else to do. And we knew that at 9 o'clock at night on a Saturday, that they would all be watching the burning of the man. So it seemed like a great time to test this notion that there's some sort of collective attention that would act as an ordering force. So we found significant cross-correlations among the six random number generators. But more importantly, we used a measure called mutual information, which is, in information terms, the same as entanglement. Mm-hmm. And the prediction was that mutual information among the various generators ought to become non-zero around the time of the burning of the man. And that is precisely what we saw.
Wonderful.
So at this year, right as I speaking now, it'll happen tomorrow evening, will be the burning of the man for the 2014 Burning Man Festival. And this time we have several dozen random generators out in the desert. And among other things, besides looking at cross-correlations and mutual information, we hope to be able to measure something like the shape of the field itself. Because we're postulating that consciousness has field-like properties, but we've never been able to measure if, it, in fact, it has a topology. So we've set the generators out in such a way so that if there is a topological shape, like a disturbance in the force, to use a Star Wars metaphor, that we will be able to detect it.
How would you do that?
Well,
how would it appear if it did happen?
Well, the null hypothesis would say that if you imagine that you can build a topology by putting the generators on a grid. You have a grid spaced out all around the desert. And so the amount of information shared from one generator to the next should be zero, so you should have a flat grid.
Mm-hmm.
If the grid is anything other than flat during the burning of the man, we'll see it immediately. Because you get a peak in the center and it drops off in the back, or who knows what it's going to look like. But if I had a guess, I would guess that it's going to look something like dropping a rock into a pond.
Yes. And the action of the burning man would be taking place right in the center of that grid?
We weren't clear that we'll be able to get a grid that is exactly that in the center, but something like that. Because the grid should be completely flat. It almost doesn't even matter where it is. But we can't get too close to the man because it's going to burn. We can't get too far behind it because it's empty out there. But we'll do the best that we can. And the important thing is that we'll have dozens of measurements to be able to cross-correlate and see if there's any warping in the shape at all.
That is fascinating. How do I find out how that works? Because now I'm going to be very curious.
Well, we'll get the data back when people return from Burning Man. Each random generator has, I forget exactly, but maybe a 32-gigabyte flash drive, and that's what's recording the data for each device.
Hmm.
So they have to collect all the devices, which are hidden and buried out in the desert, collect them all up, get all of the data, and we calculated it'll be about 700 gigabytes of data.
All right, that'll take a while.
It's going to take a little while to be able to simply work through it and continually refine the data so you have something that you can stick into a single computer. And then we'll find out. I mean, the concept that we're looking at is pretty simple. Are we looking at a flat space? Are we looking at a warp space? I imagine it'll take around 3 months before we'll get to the point where we actually have some kind of answer to that.
Well, look forward to that. That is a fascinating concept. You know, now that I'm retired from the active research, I am fascinated to follow what other people are doing. Mm-hmm. And in particular, so gratified that other people are continuing to do it. It gives me a sense, it alleviates my guilt at retirement. Your time will come, Dean. But where do you see yourself going next? Do you have any plans other than this Burning Man project and the only Burning Man and only photon counting and so forth? But do you have any other irons in the fire that you're looking forward to?
I always have a list of about 50 experiments that I want to do. So at this time of year, every 2 years, is a call for proposals from the BEOL Foundation, which is a Portuguese foundation that supports this kind of research. So my colleagues and I have just submitted 8 grant proposals for different projects. And this is a subset of things that we all want to do. We all think that would be interesting and help advance the field. I could easily have submitted 20 if I had the time and the energy to be able to do that many, because there's a gazillion things that would be interesting to do. So I certainly did not have either a deficit of ideas, or, as some of our colleagues feel, that they get paralyzed after a while from thinking how difficult all of this is. And their concern is that usual scientific epistemologies don't work that well. As you said, that if we're dealing with things that are space-time independent and where the experimenter has to be considered part of the system and all of those things, it does make running experiments very difficult. On the other hand, we can be clever and we can begin to find ways of piecing apart all of the various factors. And so maybe we're clever enough to actually make some advancements here.
Well, I think an important component of all of this is the playfulness of it. As long as you're enjoying it and having fun, you know, you're not only motivated to keep going and to come up with new creative ideas, but I think that playfulness may turn out to be an important component of the effects you get.
I think you're right. And the reason it's true is because it reduces ego involvement in it.
Yes.
When you're having fun with something, you're not thinking about you're now getting grandiose ideas about taking over the world. You're being more like a child and simply enjoying the process itself. And that is the way I usually do these things. I'm just having fun.
Yeah, I know that feeling well. I know that, you know, as you're aware, the PEAR program had a lot of constraints imposed upon it from its environment and the administration and so forth that really limited the number of questions that could be asked and the kind of experiments that could be done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get to a point after 20-odd years of saying, you know, this is starting to get boring. Feeling frustrated at not being able to move beyond those limits, which is, of course, the reason we decided to close the program at that point. That sense of fun, now that we're out of it and we're back, you know, doing ICRL and talking to folks like you and having these conversations, this is fun. And I'm enjoying it immensely. Mm-hmm. As I'm enjoying, you know, the books that we've been publishing, it's a whole different angle on it. And frankly, Dean, I don't miss the statistics too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the reasons why I've been in and out of academia and mostly have been able to do this work outside of the academic world, and I think that's why I've managed to retain some sense of fun almost continuously. Because doing this in the academic world was absolutely not fun.
No, it isn't fun. I don't think they understand fun in the academic world.
Well, no, you have to be serious all the time.
That's, I know, not fun. That was one of the first things I noticed when I first came to Princeton. It was, nobody around here smiles.
Yep. No, but you're not serious. You can't be a scientist, exactly, or a scholar if you show any sense of humor.
I know. And I used to smile at people, and I think it made them so nervous.
Right.
Listen, we are starting to get short on time, and I want to be sure that our listeners get the information they need so they can get access to your great books and perhaps to your website where you describe some of the work that you're doing. Why don't you mention those, the publisher and the books, and how they can be obtained? Because I will give it a plug right now and say I've read all of Dean's books and they are great. They're well written, they're easy to read, and the content is just fascinating. Of course, I'm prejudiced, but it still is fascinating.
Well, so you can go to supernormalbook.com. You can go to my website, deanraden.com, where you can go to the Institute of Noetic Sciences website, which is noetic.org. And learn many, many wonderful things.
Okay, and your books are available online and in bookstores and so forth?
Everywhere where books are sold.
Okay. Well, dear listeners, please avail yourself of this. If you're listening today, That means you're interested in this topic. And if you're interested in this topic, you have to read Dean's work, because in my humble opinion, I think he's one of the best researchers, if not the best researchers in the field today. And I am just so pleased that you had the time and could chat with us and catch us up on some of the things you've been doing. And do stay in touch and carry on the good work.
Well, thank you very much. And actually, if we have time, I can mention one other project that I'm working on, which, if it comes to fruition, could change everything.
All right. Well, that we always have time for.
Okay. So one of the long, persistent anecdotes about psychic ability is that it runs in families. And yet, when you look at the literature, so far there haven't been any studies other than qualitative interviews that have looked at whether or not this might be true. And so the only actual study that I'm aware of was by a lady named Sherry Cohen, who did her dissertation at the University of Edinburgh. And since it's in Scotland, she did it on the phenomenon of second sight, which is said to run through families. But what I'm doing now is working with a professor of genetics at Stanford University, and we're going to use the most modern genetic techniques to test this idea that there's actually a genetic component that runs in families. And the nice thing about all this is that we're able to now run the entire genome of each individual that we select. It used to cost $1 billion. Now it costs $1,500. So we're going to run the full genome of each person we select, both people and families who report psychic phenomena, which we'll vet as best as we can, and also people who don't report anything. They're family members who have never had any kind of psychic experience at all. That becomes our control group. And the promise of all of this is that if there is a genetic component, that, of course, immediately leads to the possibility of finding ways of both enhancing it and suppressing it.
That's fascinating.
On the enhancement side, it is very unlikely that there's a single gene that is responsible for this. But in the last 5 years, it's been found that there are networks of genes that strongly correlate with cognitive and perceptual ability. 50% of the variance is accounted for by these genetic networks. So if it turns out that there's something like that for psychic ability as well, that there are certain genetic networks, we know that there are pharmaceuticals that can enhance and suppress those networks. Now, the suppression side is interesting because most of the contacts I get by email and phone calls are people who want to turn it off.
Yeah.
And maybe they're schizophrenic, maybe they're not, but they're disturbed by what sounds like psychic phenomena. So we will be able to help them by at least suppressing that particular kind of feeling. But on the other side, if you find somebody who has the markers for talent, we might be able to actually soup it up. And this raises ethical questions. It raises all kinds of interesting questions. But it would be really, really interesting if this turns out to be so, because we can then completely finesse this century-long debate about, is there anything at all? And now we have a completely new kind of debate, which is, well, what do we do with it now?
That's marvelous. It would also be interesting to see whether, you do find some network that correlates with it, if there's any correlation between that network and others. My hunch would be, if there is a network associated with creativity or humor, is there a humor gene?
Maybe. it's probably, again, not going to be one gene, but there might be a network that is related to creativity and different personality traits. Yes.
Or playfulness. Yeah. My hunch would be it's not going to correlate with cognitive ability as much as with an emotional empathy. It brings us back to the beginning of our chat, doesn't it? But that will be fascinating. I hope you are able to get the funding to do that. I would look forward to seeing the results. Great. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to sign off now. Thank you, Dean. Thank all of you out there for sharing this hour with us. And do get in touch with Dean and do read his books. Look at his website. This guy has a lot of important stuff to share. Dean, take good care, and we'll be in touch.
Very good. Thank you.